Hey guys, welcome to the MC Anime Podcast.
We cover anime, geek culture, Japanese aesthetics, and Asian studies. We are a multi-fandom podcast, and you can expect to hear topics in your favorite hobby or fandom activity potentially. You can find MC Anime on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. Also, please check out mcanimepodcast.com, our website. Furthermore, stay tuned in for another episode.
Hey guys, this is MC from MC Anime Project. We're back with another episode, and Leslie's back with us today. How you doing, Leslie?
I'm going to do my good impression of MC. Hi guys, how you doing? I'm just kidding, I like Drowth him, but I mean, you bring up a good topic, so of course I had to jump in here and talk about it.
Of course. Anytime I have you, I think about this stuff.
Yes, I'm the good stuff.
Yeah, interesting. So, tell me a little about yourself, and then we get into the episode.
I host my own podcast called The Lessons Made Podcast, as well as a photographer. And my podcast is just going general, just talking to different people with different views and discussions. And I've been working on it to make it bigger and better with the help of MC here. So there you go. That's me.
So further ado, we're going to do Pre-Code Horror, 1930s. So we're going to cover movies during the pre-code Hollywood, but with the twist of the 1930s, where most of the universe, some of the big universal monsters came out, and some other ones.
Okay, now I gotta ask, what does pre-code mean?
Pre-code is the time period in which there was very strict on what you could air. So a lot of times, you're like, out on sex, you know, drug filming and stuff like that. Okay. It was very strict on what you could, on the censor guidelines, but there's also a time where they got away with other stuff like drugs and violence, all kinds of stuff.
Okay, I just wanted to ask because like he keeps, every time in our pre-production discussion, there's always pre-code, and I'm like, I don't really know what that means. I could have Googled it, but, you know, not my job to do that. I'm just here to give my opinion and my voice and my take. So that's why I wanted to ask.
Well, it was during the American film industry between the widespread of sound in the 1920s and then the Motion Picture Production Code censorship guidelines, which is the Hays Code. So the oversight was poor, did not become enforced until 1934. The establishment of the Poe administration before that date was restricted more by local laws, navigation, being the studio committee, and the major studio. So as a result, some of the film had innuendo, romantic, and relationships between white and black people, profanity, illegal drug use, and prostitution, and all kinds of other stuff.
So you're saying that was happening during the 1920s and 1930s?
Well, this is an era before code was established in 1934.
Mm-hmm.
But it's into the late 20s, and then the Hays Code was adapted in 1930, but it wasn't actually really enforced until 1934. But Hays Code was the first attempt at regulating what was on the airways in the movie industry.
So you're saying before that, they just have none but sex, drugs, rock and roll, and fucking, right?
Some could have had it. I don't think they had that far. I think they had innuendo more. They were still restricted by local laws.
Okay.
So local laws and the studios kind of did what they would want it to do.
Okay. Now that I've learned something new, let's talk about these monsters.
Yes. So, but yeah, that's the time in which these films come from. But specifically for pre-code horror, that the Great Depression was great for the escapism. Escapism in movies became mainstream, and the way that horror films and science fiction became into play was really apparent in how the introduction of sound, special effects, and overall tension created by the use of sound and special effects.
Yeah.
Feel exemplify a particular asset to people's emotions and what they could feel in that film. And horror is pretty broad when it comes to it, because you have like psychological, sci-fi related, supernatural, and typically some of the movies we're talking about dive into supernatural, and then some of them actually dive into the sci-fi a little bit as well.
Yeah, they do.
But in the mainstream of our discussion, basically, the nightmare picture was the psychological terror and horror intercourse. The two main types of pre-code horror were the single monster movie and films where masses of hideous beasts rose up and attacked the betters, which is the people that made them or the people around them.
That's true.
So that's typically what horror was, the nightmare picture and the name depiction. So the single monster movies, well, we're going to cover three. That would be Dracula, Bride of Frankenstein, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yes.
So what was your take on Dracula from 1931? Before, you know, this is after Nosferatu came in 1922.
Yeah, see, and that's the thing is, like, the Dracula and Nosferatu, especially since they're being so close, I kind of get them intermingled. Yeah. But I just remember that the music and maybe just the... I think Nosferatu was more of a silent film. It had,
well,
like...
a silent film with a symphony.
Yeah, the symphony. But Dracula is where, you know, you... probably start getting where he turns get some of the Hollywood, you know, trope that you see nowadays of telling the story of Dracula. You know, he's a vampire, he can't be seen in a mirror, and since Hollywood at the time were just about making movies and more focused on actors, the actors themselves had to be that character and bring it to life near the... It was scary because he had to make Dracula be, you know, a mysterious vampire, you know, an old being that's terrifying. He had to bring that terrifying feeling to life. Unlike, you know, modern day where they do a lot of editing and they're giving you that shock value. This is more of like psychologically. So in watching Dracula a couple of times, it's like a psychological thing because, you know, did he actually have powers to, you know, have a psychic link or telepathically be able to control the victims? And everything else, that's something that Dracula added to his already amazing legend.
Yeah.
You know, I think that was the biggest part. It was like a psychological thriller of like, does he have all these powers just to be able to control someone's mind and have them be, you know, his... turning them into a vampire or just being his next meal?
Yeah. Well, Dracula 1931 was the first sound film adaptation of the Stoker novel of the same name. Because it was previously on Broadway, but it was a play instead of a movie. So it being the first sound film really changed. It really became more of Universal monsters in this time.
I did not know that it was actually a play before then, but, you know, it makes sense.
Well, different adaptations probably get different audiences throughout the novel, because the novel from the 1800s, 1890s, I think.
Bram Stoker's, you know, when he went into supposedly Transylvania, it was actually Romania and all this stuff. Yeah, it's where a lot of these characters come from, the late 1800s.
Well, so they fit in that to that. Well, Dracula is pretty interesting. It also fits in the supernatural horror with a single beast element.
Yes.
But you don't really consider Dracula as a beast necessarily, but more of a single monster.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even really consider him a monster, really, but he is.
He's a human in monster form. That typically was the main focus in the early horror genre, was using a human or humanoid, but they're a monster at the same time. So it's really embracing the inner human monster inside all of us.
Yeah.
That was the metaphor.
You're right. It is a metaphor. Now that I think about that, it totally makes sense that he is a human, but he's has, you know, a monstrous appear to him, even if it is not, you know, prevalent in how he's portrayed.
True. It's kind of interesting because Count Dracula's castle in Transylvania, we get established to Renfield, who's on the business. He goes to the village. They fear the vampires. They warn him not to go there. And he stays at the... He refuses to stay at the village inn, asks the carriage to take him to the Borgo Pass, but he's driven by the castle by Dracula's coach. So Dracula is the driver. En route, he sticks his head out to ask the driver to slow down, but he sees the driver has disappeared. A bat leads the... So envision that for a second. Dracula is the driver. You, all of a sudden, you tell the driver to slow down, and then you see the bat leading the horses. How does that look to you?
Like, somehow the bat has to... The horses have to know who the bat is, right?
I guess. That's one thought. But you're in this empty carriage with no driver. And you're a regular human, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. So, I would find that's very out of the ordinary, and it would be making my adrenaline and my stress level be like, what the hell am I looking at? Right?
Yeah.
Then when you picture it like that, you have to be, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah. So it's really symbolizing on the fact that Dracula is mysterious. He hypnotizes him, and then they go into the castle in the England setting, and unknowns to him, he's a vampire. Renfield doesn't know it, so that's really the main plot line living there in the movie. So it really does set up the tension in the beginning, and over time, it introduces lore into the film.
Yeah. No.
When you watched Dracula or versions of Dracula, what was your interpretation of it?
That supposedly Dracula is supposed to be like the first and most pure like vampire. He's supposed to be like the lord of all the vampires and that, or the father. That's what he's supposed to make out, and that he's just this like such a force, and like people are drawn to him because of rather they know that he's a vampire and he's lived a long life, or there's just that mystique of him, you know, that just draws people to him, and then he, you know, has the ability to, you know, supposedly hypnotize you, and he can fly. He is, you know, especially like modern interpretations of him, he's looked at as kind of like a sexy, you know, suave, you know, medieval European, you know, prince or something. You know, he's been around, so he has that. He's, you know, and he's also strong, so he's supposed to be able to fight pretty good, and he command. He's just like a very, his presence is this felt just by him being around. Rather, yeah. Just by his mystique, or, you know, subconsciously his supposedly telekinetic or hypnotic effect on people. People want to be around him.
Yeah. And the actor that was playing director in the 1931 film was also really good. The would appear in other films, but he would really capture his essence of Dracula through this, which propelled him in other horror movies as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like he got stereotyped. You know how, especially, you always get actors that are, you know, a tough guy, where they only can play in romantic comedies or serious roles, or, you know, or they're a cop, or, you know what I mean? He's probably like the first one to get stereotyped into being Dracula. That's all he was ever known as.
True. I mean, you know, with all the different adaptations of Dracula over the years, I think it's been definitely one of the more thought out universal monsters in the franchise. And it definitely represents that vampire in its subgenre that wasn't really as apparent, became more apparent because of Dracula.
Dracula definitely made vampires into what they are now. Not taking anything away from Nosferatu, but
yeah.
Dracula was definitely the more noticeable vampire movie that was made, you know?
Yeah, because the film is establishing the popular on-screen image of the vampire. The cinematic horror genre was born with the release of Dracula itself.
Yes.
So if you really overthink, you know, the stage bound in the middle section, the virtues of the stark performance and general visual style outweigh any such deficits, you really have this one piece of, you know, the portrayal of Dracula and the creepy aesthetic, but also the standard for major vampiric roles ever since then. You really established the character as a founding subgenre for an entirely new hyper horror.
It was the first, and they, you know, made so many vampire or Dracula movies that they came along, you know. I mean, there's, especially now where we're at, there's so many of them, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. It hasn't been oversaturated that much in recent years, but I mean, you know, 90s into the 2010s, it was all over, you know. But and it all started with Dracula in the 1930s.
It's interesting how Dracula has influenced the pop culture, not only for vampires but for horror, but it can stand out on its own and be self-mentioned.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
but that's one of our famous Universal loves. Our second is going to be Frankenstein, specifically talking about Bride of Frankenstein. They said that's the best sequel of a long time when it came out.
Yeah, they're definitely, and they came out not too long after one of the original Frankensteins came out.
Yes. Original Frankenstein was 1931, the same year as Dracula. But Dracula was first, then Frankenstein.
I did not know that. Dang. Right there.
So, that's when Universal became so apparent in cinematography and horror with these single-use monsters like the Mummy, the Invisible Man, Bride of Frankenstein, and it's also the Wolfman.
Oh, God. I totally forgot about Wolfman. Wow.
Wolfman is also mentioned from 1940s, but it's still apparent.
Yeah. So, what about the Bride of Frankenstein? Did you like more than the original Frankenstein?
I think that the Bride of Frankenstein was a really treasuring of what Frankenstein had, because in the original movie, he didn't really have anybody and was misunderstood until the doctor made him a wife. Now he has an actual wife, now he can communicate with and understand him. Because Frankenstein, the Frankenstein monster, is more of a symbolism of the unknown. People are not understanding what they don't know. And then when he tries to seek interaction, it just becomes this, the humans are terrified of him. He reacts, and it ends up just being misunderstood.
Yeah, and I know in a lot of Frankenstein movies I see, like, he's not always this, like, mindless monster that does bad. You know, there's also times where in the movie that they even show him in, like, a more of a, like, nicer role, or like a good person or whatever, even though he was a creature created by of different body parts by a mad scientist that wanted to, you know, and that's what he is. He definitely is. It's the Frankenstein monster is the personification of fear of the unknown. That is what you said is basically what he is. And I guess to make him not feel so alone, they created the Bride of Frankenstein, or the Bride of Frankenstein's monster, really.
Well, but she invokes a different thing that Frankenstein doesn't have. She's more, you know, her hairdo is really popping, while his is more simple. But in the same way, she has the, you know, white flash of gray in her hair that's her as animated as well.
Maybe it's like the updated, you know, because you created the original and then you can build back better and into a better creature, you know? Maybe that's what Bride of Frankenstein is supposed to is, you know, showing that, yeah, we had the original he was made, but we can do better, and that's what she was.
Or give an aesthetic that was missing in the original.
Which is?
Well, then in the original you just have the fear of the unknown. But this is actually giving more aesthetic to Frankenstein, but also the doctor itself. Now the doctor is recognizing that I made Frankenstein, but let's make Frankenstein a wife because he's lonely.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's like, you know, that way he's not lonely and, you know, the two can be in love and they're never going to feel alone, and it helps the... And what, just so we can say this, because it's always, you got to say it. Frankenstein is not the creature that was made. Frankenstein is the name of the doctor that created him. And I just wanted to say that for the audience, because I don't know if people ever remember that or whatever, but why it's called Frankenstein is because it's the main character is the doctor, and then, you know, the secondary main antagonist or protagonist is the creature he makes. So with that being said, I feel like, if I remember correctly in the book, Frankenstein started these experiments because he lost a loved one that was a female or whatever. He lost someone close to him. I believe it might be his wife, but it might have been his fiance or whatever.
Yeah.
And he wanted to bring her to life so bad because it felt like he might be misunderstood or his life wasn't complete or whatever. And so I guess he created Frankenstein as like his, you know, his trial, his first, and it worked. And then I believe that the bride of Frankenstein is to work on the female, and it shows that what he was trying to accomplish happened, you know? That makes sense to you?
Yeah. I mean, the film's reputation has grown. It's critically considered the greatest sequel ever made. Many fans and critics consider it to be an improvement on the original, and also as a whale's masterpiece. And it was also just like Dracula, was also a national film registry for cultural, historic, or aesthetically significant for its status in the actual horror genre.
Yeah, because if you think about Frankenstein, that it's the first movie of them kind of creating something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They created a monster or a being or whatever, and that itself is such a big horror genre itself, or subgenre, however you want to say it. There's so many stories about humans making something, and Frankenstein basically started all that, made that into what it is.
Well, it takes back place in the same capsule where it was created, but now we have the story of Frankenstein the monster, but we have the intention for writing the novel to crack a moral lesson. Mortal man who tries to play God. And we say it's more of the story to tell. The scene shifts to the 1931 movie, where villagers gather around the burning windmill to cheer the apparent death of the monster. Hands the father of the girl, the creature drowned, wants to see the monster's bones. But it's actually revealed that Frankenstein is alive. It just faked the death. What do you think about that?
Faking the death, that's also like the first one of, like, you can make a sequel using the same monster.
Yeah.
Kind of, that also is a trope that is used so they can have sequels, you know? It's like, oh, we killed the monster. No, you didn't, you know? Like, I know that's a big horror story, movie, creepypasta cliche, is if they're like, oh, we defeated the evil that's here, but then it's like, you know, you're watching a movie at the very end, you see it moving or whatever. They kind of leave it to, if they want to do a sequel or continue the story or whatever, they kind of leave it open-ended.
True. And, you know, with the establishment of finding the wife and her being terrified, and then over time, her understanding Frankenstein was also interesting. Because when she was animated, similar way that Frankenstein was, through electricity and electrocution, to animate the body, she's not really aware. So Frankenstein's actually helping her to be more aware.
Yeah, I never really thought of it from that perspective, but it also is that they're both basically the same. They have so much in common because they were created. One's a male, one is a female. And they're like the only two of their kind. So they're the only two that can understand what each other's been through or thinking or being, because they were created basically the same way.
And, you know, Frankenstein has a similar legacy as Dracula, but Frankenstein is more standalone. It's not really influenced the entire genre like Dracula did.
So you're saying that Frankenstein movie did not create its own genre like Dracula did?
War Greatest on genre, but it's very unique. It's very single Frankenstein.
Yeah, because you can say that, but I do think, like Loda said earlier, is that Frankenstein created the human trying to play God, creating something that they can't control. But you can't say that the Frankenstein monster is its own because it was just the Frankenstein creature that was made.
Well,
it can't be his own standalone thing, as you're saying. But, you know, as you said, Frankenstein, I think, created the genre of humans try to mess with things they don't understand and they create something.
True. I think with the Bride of Frankenstein, particularly, with it showcasing a sequel, but in a way that is actually understanding and really well done from the Frankenstein 1971 version.
Yeah, well, definitely. It might be a little bit better because they already shot one. They already have, like, a source material to work off of and then, you know, make better. You know, like, do the movie better, tell the story kind of the same way, but they could add more things to it that are, you know, think might make the story seem more acceptable, more plausible, more, you know, interesting to the people that are going to watch it.
True.
They already had the blueprint. They just needed to, you know, tweak it a little bit.
Yeah, and also having the groundwork already set up from the previous film, it really was easier to go off the source material, but also create the Bride of Frankenstein is just as unique as Frankenstein himself. And
yeah,
different level to his core.
You know, because it is a different... It's just a different gender or sex because you're talking about using male body parts and then you switch over to using female body parts. And at the time, it's probably a little bit more taboo because of just the time that the movie was made, you know? So, I mean, it might have been a little bit more of a shocker. If I may say so, that's what I would think would be happening because it's just the times of how it was. Women weren't looked at as they are now.
Well, just like Frankenstein was the man who made a monster, Bride of Frankenstein was the man who made a bride to the monster of man.
Yes.
Who made a monster. So,
yeah.
So you can see that the campaign for these were pretty literal and invoke a simple method of like a subheading to advertise the movie. And a lot of times that's what they did. For early horror genre, they had a simple message, but it was invoking to what it actually was.
Exactly how you said it. I really can't say anything more about it, but it's the same movie, but they already had source material, but it was also a different story, you know?
Yeah. Interesting how it actually all came about.
And like you said, it's telling the story a different way from a different perspective. And it came out and it did well. It's still talked about to this day, as you see, almost 100 years later.
Yeah, it's what we call a standalone feature that still speaks volumes to what it is, what it can represent.
Exactly.
Being the unknown and having an uncontrollable beast is kind of synonymous with how Frankenstein came about. But, you know, just because Frankenstein streamlined that particular aspect, I think there was also stories before it with an uncontrollable beast, but Frankenstein shifted how to make it a really enjoyable story.
Also maybe things makes it a little bit more relatable or whatever. It wasn't just like some accident or whatever. You had like a scientist, you know, who's smart and using his smart to, you know, test the laws of nature and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
but yeah, that's part of Frankenstein. It still lives on as the better sequel of many other movies and kind of kicks off Frankenstein in a totally different way.
Yep.
And, you know, of course, we had Dracula's daughter, but I don't think that did as well as Bride of Frankenstein, I think.
You have a daughter, that's just weird.
that's what they did, that same following up the Bride of Frankenstein.
So. Sometimes you can hit so many home runs, but every now and then you're going to strike out with something. You know, it's my baseball analogy. And, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to go to the next single feature monster is the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. 1931 as well.
1931 is the movie of is the year of horror movies.
Yes. So it really it's an adaptation of The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, a tale of a man who takes a potion which turns him into a mild-mannered man of science, into a almost
homicidal.
Homicidal maniac, yeah.
Come on, use your big boy words, Mason. We can do this. He's like, shut up. All right.
So, what do you think of a man who's mannered but has a blend of science that makes him Dr. Jekyll and then Mr. Hyde? Like, two different sides of him. Like, a coin, one flip, one out.
Well, I believe that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde represents every single human being on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Due to the fact that we have the what we call like our good side, or more of our passive side. And then,
yep.
You know, maybe even if you don't have like a dark side that you act on or whatever, but everybody, they get mad. They have thoughts of, you know, like wanting to act upon thoughts that are would not be. So it's like, hey, you know, you have the, you're the good natured, you try to see the good in everything, but then, you know, you live in a world where, especially nowadays, where people just can be assholes for no fucking reason, and they suck, and it's just like, you know, you get cut off in traffic, you're like, oh, this freaking asshole that's cut me off in traffic or whatever, and then you're like, now I just want to beat, you know, you have that other side of you that, you know, so of you that's maybe not as nice. You kind of go into more primitive things of like, you know, I want to fight back. I want to be mean. I want a little bit more darker, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's also the fact that the creator is Dr. Jekyll himself, and Mr. Hyde is just an ultra persona that comes out, but also has the same control of the body.
Like I said, it's basically a split personality. It's like the first movie you would talk about that, because you have a person that's in charge and then he takes the potion and the other personality is in complete control. So it's the first to talk about someone having split personalities, which is, I think, created its own, you know, horror genre right now, because there's a lot of movies out there about people with split personalities, superheroes, villains, horror characters. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde created that. You know, it's one person, but they have a good side and an evil side.
Yeah.
And it's to talk about the, I think it basically, to me, what I said, it's about all humans. It's always the internal struggle you have with yourself about decisions you make. It's human nature in a nutshell. You know, you can do what people like, what is the supposedly the right way to do it, or you can just go, maybe it's the not so right way to do it. And I believe it's that internal struggle that everybody deals with, maybe on a day-to-day basis, or like a Biden, you know, everyone struggles to make sure that they try to be the nicest that they can be, or you know, the worst they can be.
And you know, you also have to know that this was a film in the box office on par with the Universal monster films of the era. So it did really well for the split persona, but it also kind of gives its own standing as, you know, it's an old-fashioned atmosphere. Mm-hmm. You have the costumes and the set designs being actually pleasing to the eye, but it also gives us as an audience this subtlety. This is what the atmosphere is. It's a slow build-up. It actually is getting us to a transformation that is a real gut-wrencher, you know? It actually drives the tension and then building up the movie. But it didn't really need a climax per se, but the building of it was what stole Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for that representation.
You know, you're talking about here in the aesthetic of the movie is the buildup of the conclusion or the climax or the inevitable high point of the movie.
Yeah.
Which it is something that's still done today, and I think it's probably like the first movie that maybe done it like perfectly or made the formula for. because it's building up. It's a little slow, but it's building up to this moment, and you're like, wow, okay, that the payoff was great. You know, all the build up to it and everything is amazing.
Yeah, and that's what I liked about it, because the slow build up was something that doesn't always happen in movies. Usually when they do it, they don't do it right. But Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, an example of them doing it right, but in a more significant way. They were able to tell the tension, tell the story between his struggle of the Hyde character coming out and Dr. Jekyll trying to suppress it and trying to cope with it and seal him and trying to deal with it and coming to the conclusion that maybe being Mr. Hyde is not necessarily the best way to be if I want to keep my sanity as this person, as the person he created in the first place. That balance of it overpowering him is what really tells the story.
And that brings me back again. It is a balance of your internal struggle. That is basically what the whole movie to me is about. Anytime we talk about it, it's your internal balance and trying to make them work together instead of opposite. You know, trying to be that one perfect version of yourself instead of having two that are trying to always separate. You want them to work together. And I feel that's what his whole struggle was. And he finally, at the end of the movie, or he figures it out.
Yeah.
He can have both of these, you know, personas or personalities or parts of him work together as one instead of always trying to pull apart, you know, and fighting over control.
True. And also, with the scientist side, really comes into light how he's able to create the serum to control the beast in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, that can also, like I said, just going to talking about human struggles is people and making a potion, that's why people will resort to drugs or to, you know, the bottle or other things, because they're kind of suppressed some part of their life that makes them be unhappy, and that's how they cope with it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not saying that that's what I got from him, but that's just another thing you can think of when we talk about this movie of him. He's trying to suppress an unpleasant part of his life with something that he made.
True, but he's also coping in a way that is actually done well.
Yeah, well, I mean, just in modern day times, you know, you can cope with things with certain things, but he's also, I feel like, getting his brain or the mental health of it, you know, taken care of. You know, he's addressing all causes of it, you know, to make himself better. Does that make sense to you? You know?
Oh, yeah.
He's taking the steps to, on all fronts, to make himself be, you know, synchronized with both parts of his being. And he uses a potion to help out, but he's also addressing it mentally himself. He's not just going to cope with it and, you know, hope it goes away. He's actually trying to deal with it head on.
Yeah. And with him being able to deal with it in the way he does, it tells the story. What am I doing? Did I do this right? You see his tension build up because of the internal conflict that he gave himself. So in total confidence, great. It tells a great story. And sometimes it's even better to showcase the internal conflict as much as possible, which this does in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But
yeah,
it also sounds like Dr. Jekyll is the monster and Mr. Hyde is the man. So it's really interesting that the Dr. Jekyll is actually the scientist and Mr. Hyde is the monster.
I mean, you can look at it that way, you know, maybe him being as this doctor or whatever is, Dr. Jekyll is the part that is not the dominant personality, but he was created to keep, you know, Mr. Hyde, which is the supposed more dangerous personality, you know.
In check.
Yeah, in check.
It's a representation of the unhinged society and man. And Dr. Jekyll is the more sophisticated kind, and that's the kind of balance.
Yeah, you can even look at it like that. It makes perfect sense. Wow, I just hit my microphone, sorry, but it's perfect sense right there. You know, you have the unhinged, maybe the bottom of the barrel, the people that are, you know, the bad element or the bad apples, the criminal element, and then you have people that are sophisticated, living the life, paying their taxes, and trying to live, make the world a better place, while the other part is trying to, you know, only worry about themselves and take advantage.
So, but yeah, that's what Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde represent. Let's go to some honorable mention. And let's kick off with King Kong, because that definitely was mainstreamed during this time as well, and had similar elements that our horror films can offer.
The first thing we realized is King Kong has a thing for blondes. It did happen. Like, every Kong movie, he's always grabbing a hot blonde chick. Anyways, but or you listen to him or whatever. Even in the new Kong movie, there's always a blonde chick, you know, that he's, like, infatuated.
And King Kong was with stop-motion animation.
Yeah, claymation.
Yeah.
Which, I don't... They did it, you know? They did. You used to do a lot of creatures like that back in the day that were monsters. What I remember, the original Jason and the Argonauts, I think, was made in the 40s or 50s. And even some, like, Godzilla, you know, type monsters that they had from the, I think it was, like, the 1940s or whatever. They had a bunch of those different monsters that come out. It's either a dude in a suit or using some kind of, like, claymation type thing. Heck, even in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the Abominable Snowman was a claymation stop-motion capture monster. So, I mean, it's been around for a while. It's just not done because, you know, we have CGI and all that. But anyway, back to the, you know, it is something of, you go and, I think it's like the modern world visiting the ancient world, or the old world, is what I
yep.
think.
Yeah,
and
it is.
That, you bring out, you capture King Kong and you bring him into a world he knows nothing about. Yeah, he's going to get scared. He's going to, like, not know what to do. And that's basically what the, to me, it talks about as, like, a societal thing. Is you're taking somebody or something from the only world that they know and you're bringing them into a totally different place. And you see how they, like, try to just deal with it.
Oh, yeah. And you know, Kong climbing the Empire State Building was literally the image that people associated with the 1933 King Kong.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting, as a parent, of how it's released and then the other representation of the Monsterverse over the years, too. Because this is a giant monster film. It's a monster film, but it's It blends of more science fiction.
Yeah.
Than super... Well, it dives into some of the supernatural, but it's like giant-sized versions.
Yeah, it's not really like a horror. I guess you'd call it like a thriller because, you know, But not what you call like a horror where it's like a monster jump scares and like...
But it has a similar aesthetic to a monster creating tension and giving an audience a character that's in the battle. So
exactly.
The legacy of Kong was pretty much this, you know, the subframe motion effect was really good, lacking impact in the film industry, but influencing like all the different other ones like Beast from the 20,000 Fandoms, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, Mothra, Jurassic Park. So
the Godzilla from the
Godzilla franchise, you know, it really sets up to input giant monsters as a whole. So it's really important for that. And, you know, overall, it has a really good aesthetic feel over the years. It has so many different sequels that came back from it. Yeah. I like it. It's been definitely introduced in pop culture, and 1930s was definitely the time for it.
Yeah.
Now let's go to Invisible Man. How was that cultural just as King Kong was?
You know, I guess Invisible Man is, if I remember correctly, the dude was some kind of scientist or worked with scientists, and he found like it was a potion or something that was made that turned him completely invisible. And the only way you can see him or whatever, he had to wear some kind of clothing. That's why you see him usually with like a hat or glasses or whatever. It just made him not be seen by the normal human eyes.
Cool.
And that's why he was, you know, it was science. Again, you know, we talked about Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and Bride of Frankenstein. It's dealing with science doing something that to the human, and the Invisible Man is like, he no longer be seen. You know, it's hard for him to like talk to people, interact, because he literally cannot be seen. And I feel like it might mess with his psyche a little bit, because no matter what he did or he does, nobody's gonna see him. It's hard for him to have a lot, you know what I mean? So yeah. I feel like maybe like more of the psychologically talks about that or shows that, because he had an accident and then now he's not seen as the same person anymore. And it deals with him trying to cope with that.
True. And the thing with the legacy of Invisible Man specifically is it's standalone. So when Universal revived him as a character for future, he didn't have to be connect any other films with a direct story like The Mummy or The Frankenstein.
Yeah.
You know, when the Invisible Man returns, we have like different formula from Dr. Frank, and then we have the different, like, then The Invisible Man's Revenge. Also, because The Invisible Man Returns in 1939 was the set of Frankenstein, so they really have been developing the character over the years and revived it in a way that was interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, it's one of the first ones where it's not, he's not some creature or whatever, he just had an accident, and it's kind of horror because now he can't be seen, so he can kind of do what he wants, you know, and you can't really tell where he's at.
Yeah, I think, you know, this ability, not knowing where this character could be, really drives his hype even lower, because now you convey a character that's only his body is seen, but not face, mostly.
But if you're not wearing any clothes, you can't even see his body.
True, but that's why it's so striking to have the covering and bandages to reveal as a bottom.
Yeah, that way he can at least be seen or whatever, because, you know,
yeah.
I don't know how, whatever people say, they're a loner and all this, people want to be seen or want to interact with society some way, shape, or form.
On his as well, he has to have bandages to tell people that he is invisible with the glasses.
Yeah.
But, like, him being wrapped up with the glasses is really exotic in his image. That's Invisible Man and King Kong. They had similar success, but, you know, you can say which one had more, but that's because of how the culture represents. My honorable mention, that was Leslie's honorable mention, was The Black Cat and The Island of Lost Souls. So, The Island of Lost Souls was in 1932. It's interesting because we have a sailor. He's stranded on an island, advocated by Dr. Silence Malalo. He agrees to stay until the boat arrives. He introduces him to unknown to Parker's the Park Panther, to reveal that all the island's inhabitants are a result of the experiments to create humans from animals. He tries to persuade Loda to have, so he can continue the experiments. So it's like mind manipulation, but also the island is self-governing, but the scientist is this creator of the animal hybrids.
Okay, I've heard of, like, the story. I'd never heard of it being called the Islands of Lost Souls. I know I've always heard of a movie that talked about that, so now I gotta go watch that, because I don't think I've seen the movie. But now that you mentioned that, of, like, building animal hybrids, whatever, I'm like, I've heard about it, and I probably just didn't. That's cool. Huh.
Yeah. The description is, the Panther Woman lures a man not only in body, not only to destroy him, but body and soul. So
that's
the Panther Woman is the manipulation to get him to stay on the island to continue the experiments.
Yeah, but that's just what women do. They just sit there and they devour you, your heart and soul and everything.
So it's kind of interesting because, yeah, like, two big the players here, the scientists and the Panther Woman, being the antagonists of the story. So that's why the album mentioned for me. It stands as alone as a will you do situation if I create a new hybrid human creature.
And remember, you know, that's the probably It goes the old saying that, you know, sex sells. You know what I mean? Panther woman luring guys into coming to the island.
All right.
So that's my honorable mention of Anurag. So the Black Cat was Edgar Allan Poe's story in a movie form in 1934. So it's a comedy horror mystery with the same title, which is also suggested by the short story that Edgar Allan Poe wrote. So there's a continuous music score, and it actually has a psychological horror done by internalizing the atmosphere, the eerie sounds, the darker side of the human psyche, and the emotions like fear and guilt to deliver the scale. So it takes a different approach in psychological, because all of this is him having the guilt of killing the black cat. He sees this other black cat as a version that the cat came back, imbibing of his guilt. Because we see the skinning of the cat, and that's one of the most scary moments that the film has read, is the skinning of the cat itself. So it has a more personal human internal struggle, but so much more with the black cat represent.
So it's like Edgar Allan Poe's story. So you're saying he killed this black cat, and then he sees another one, and it starts to make him feel guilty, or the person, right?
Yes. And he's stuck doing delusions and fear, and
yep,
he just eats him alive.
Yeah, the guilt is just starting to just make him crazy.
And that's what the black cat symbolizes on, is that struggle of, like, there's also a drug paraphernalia, and like there's all these different things mixed in that really dives into the component of the struggle himself. The psychologist who says he's traveling to see an old friend, but left the home 18 years in World War I and not seen the wife since, but 15 years in an infamous prison camp in Siberia. So he comes back and he's not reformed at all, and he just completely breaks down.
Sounds like what we're talking about with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, he's trying to cope with it and not deal with it. You know, using drugs. Yeah, so interesting take. But that's definitely an Edgar Allan Poe story, because that's what I remember all the stuff reading about him.
Yeah, so it definitely goes to show you that sometimes you don't really need a monster to tell the story. You just need a metaphor to convey it, like the black cat.
Yeah, basically that's what the metaphor is, him dealing with the guilt of him, you know, all the stuff he did.
So yeah, that's our discussion on Pre-Code 4, 1930. What was your take on some of this and how it came all about?
I can say this conversation has made me look at these movies in a different way, because you brought a different perspective to me. I'm hoping I kind of did the same thing, but you really made me kind of, you know, not necessarily like change my how I think in the movies, but just how I like look at them when I watch them now. Or yeah, just the stories of these popular characters. So that's what I'm thinking about. I'm looking at them from a different perspective, or looking at the same story, but just having more to like think about with it.
Yeah. But considering that, you know, Invisible Man, King Kong, Dracula, and Bride of Frankenstein were four different films that got nationally in the Library of Congress for,
yeah,
you know, the historic, the scary, and the what it represents is insignificant for cultural. That's why they're in this place. That's why we're talking about it. That's why the 1930s was so pivotal to horror as a genre, to stand alone as a form of escapism. Because during the Great Depression, people needed something to distract them from the struggles of the economy and not having enough food and having rations for, you know, coming up from early war and the devastation from World War I, too.
Yeah.
And not having the ability to fend for yourself much was the struggle that they had. So movies is really a way for them to get out of temporary life in that moment.
Yeah. I mean, these movies, that's probably why a lot of these movies were made.
They were capitalizing on people's fears, but telling a story around it where people could see it and, like, have a shock factor that wasn't always graphic. It was more like in the development of the story itself.
Makes sense.
But well, yeah, you know, with the Hays Code at the time, or the pre-code, they really couldn't dive into more graphic nature or, you know, more shock factor that the typical movies would use. So they had to be more creative to do this family version that was still really good in the horror aspect.
Definitely had to be a little bit more creative with the things now, and they don't have the ratings, the movie rating systems we have now. So, but yeah, definitely.
We're not restricted by laws of the states and the national laws creating these different struggles how to rate these movies.
Yeah.
Now we have a universal system, and we typically accept that new system.
Exactly.
So, before we go, what was your final conclusion about this entire discussion?
You know, it's the Halloween season. It's all around me at the moment. It's a good discussion, and like I said, I learned some new stuff about old stories. So, how to look at them in a different light. That's what my take is.
True. And with classic horror, like Dracula, Wolfman, and all of them, just remember, it's the mind and body telling a story. You're in it to win it because you're involved in the story because you like it, because it tells you something of a perspective that you didn't know or didn't feel. And you can empathize, relate to the character, and have a build-up where you enjoy it and feel along with the movie. That's what these horror movies represent. Not so much scary, but like scary as tension and psychological more.
Yeah, what you just said.
So, but yeah, where can they find you, Leslie, and any future projects you're working on?
They can find me walking through a cornfield with a shovel and a clown mask. But if you want to like find me on the internet, I'm Lessons Made Podcast, or look up photography. It's Madewell Art Photography, or my name, Leslie Madewell. Google it, Yahoo, or whatever you guys use, and you'll find me there. Any project I'm working on, working on my second book, and working on trying to do some more voice acting, and I got more podcast guests I'm going to be getting with, and I'm hopefully to make it not bigger and better, but just better all around.
Well, there you go. Leslie's definitely making a strive in his personal journey and on his little project. So, there we do. This is MC signing off. Thanks for being here. And this concludes Pre-Code Horror 1930s.
This concludes another episode of MC Anime Podcast. MC Anime Podcast is available on podcast directories like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. We also have our website at mcanimepodcast.com. If you want to directly support us, then follow Patreon blog MC Anime. Finally, if you want services for hire, then we're available on Fiverr for audio and video production, graphic design, idea consulting, and blog and article writing.